Welcome to the Phases podcast, where every phase is an opportunity to evolve and empower our aging. I'm your host, Anita Goa. This episode, let me tell you, it is truly special. It's a full circle moment for me. I have the honor of welcoming my first yoga teacher and mentor, Beryl Bender Birch. What a treat this was. Beryl has been a leading force in the yoga world for decades. She's the author of several books, including the groundbreaking Power Yoga, one of the very first yoga books on the market that was published in 1995. Long before yoga became the mainstream practice it is today. With over 50 years of dedicated practice and teaching, Beryl is truly a pioneer. She was one of the few prominent women teaching Ashtanga Vinyasa Yoga at a time when it was largely dominated by men. And we talk about this. She shares her experience, including how she was shunned by Patabi Joyce, the founder of Ashtanga Vinyasa Yoga, and how that shaped her path. Beyond yoga, Beryl is a very passionate activist for animals and for the environment. It was Beryl and her late husband, Tom, who were instrumental in my own yoga journey. And in fact, I earned my yoga teaching certification through Beryl, which was a transformative experience for me that continues to influence my teaching to this day. Speaking with Beryl for this conversation was deeply healing and inspiring to me. It really brought me back to the days of soaking in her wisdom and feeling empowered by her guidance. I think if you've practiced yoga with me, you'll recognize just how much of her influence I've carried forward. So in this episode, we explore the profound teachings of yoga, meditation, and mindfulness. We talk about the importance of a consistent daily practice, the evolution of yoga, and the role discipline plays in personal growth. Beryl's insights are a reminder of how powerful and life-affirming this practice can be. So, without further ado, here's my conversation with the incredible Beryl Bender Birch. Namaste, Beryl. Thank you so much for coming on to the Phases podcast. I'm so thrilled to have you here.
Anita, it's so great to see you. We have known each other for so many decades. You were one of the charter members of the Power Yoga Club, which goes back in New York City many, many years. And so, I think as I said to you when you first reached out to ask me if I'd like to do this, I think of you all the time because I'm in the northeastern part of the United States in New England, and we have lots of snow on the ground. And many years ago, you gave me this wonderful sweater from Norway, which I still wear all the time. So every time I break it out in the wintertime, I think of you. So I'm so thrilled to be doing this.
That's so good. That is so nice. I always ask this to every guest. What is life teaching you at the moment?
Wow, that's such a profound question. We could spend the whole 45 minutes talking about that. This is it. You know, get your attention in present mind. That this is, I've been doing yoga practices, not just asana, but all of the practices since 1971. People ask me, you know, how often do you practice? And I go, I haven't missed a day since 71. I go, oh my God, you practice asana every day? I go, no, but I practice yoga every day. And that means just making an effort to be present, making an effort to pay attention. If we look at the Yoga Sutras and look at what we often call the definition of yoga, although it isn't a definition. The second sutra in book one, where Patanjali, the collator of the Yoga Sutra, says, yoga citta vritti nirodha. Yoga is the stopping or the cessation of the fluctuations of the mind. And that isn't what Patanjali there, I think, is saying, is that yoga is what happens when we're able to quiet the mind. And I think the paradox is, and this is one of the things that I'm continuously learning and remembering, and is that this paradox of thinking about thinking. You know, on the one hand, with meditation, right? Yoga is the cessation of the fluctuations of the mind. Oh, okay, well, we're trying to stop thought. Well, no, we're not trying to get rid of thought because, you know, look around you, wherever you are. Look at your computer, look at your table, your candle, your TV, anything, the windows in your house. All of that required thought to put all that together. So thought isn't the enemy. What we're trying to do is, you know, is learn to catch our thoughts, to notice when we're lost in thought and not be trapped by it, to let this mind run continuously like an out of control, you know, runaway train. And the interesting thing is once you step into meditation, and this is probably what one of the things I'm learning now is it changes you. It changes your brain. You have to learn how to meditate. Meditation isn't just closing your eyes and thinking about what you're going to do the rest of your day. A lot of people have misinterpretation about what meditation is, right? It's about learning to tell the difference between being lost in thought and being awake, being present. And once you step on this path of yoga, it's pretty rarefied air. You know, what meditation teaches us is that it's possible, again, this is what I'm learning now, to train your mind. We're never taught that in school. We're taught that we can train our bodies, you know, that you can lose 50 pounds and become a competitive triathlete. But we're not taught that we can train our mind to focus and to continuously come back to the experience of this moment, because that's all there is. So, summing all that up, this is the practice of yoga, to continuously break the spell of getting sucked in to the black hole of out-of-control thinking. And not knowing you are thinking, to wake up again and again and again. And this whole process, like the brilliant methodology of the eight limb path, starts with asana, when we begin to learn to pay attention to our alignment, to our breathing, to our body. It's that first in Buddhism, that's called the first establishment of mindfulness. Anyway, great question. I could go on and on and on, but I'm going to.
I love that. And that reminds me so much of, you would always say that I practice yoga every day, 365 days a year. I say that a lot to my students all the time, that it's not just about asana. It is about what you practice every single day. And another thing that you would always talk about was energy management. And that has stuck with me ever since then.
Yes.
Right. And it's like if you have that monkey mind, it just drains the prana out of your body. So that has been such a valuable lesson.
I'm so grateful that you contacted me, because it's so inspiring to be back in touch with you, because you've just from our short conversation prior to starting and listening to you, you've become such a good teacher. I'm so excited. You're still on the path and you're doing the work and you're trying to, you know, God, I wish you'd move back to the United States. We certainly need help over here. Oh, dear.
I don't know if I'd ever shared with you how I actually met you.
I'm trying to think back. No, I don't. I can't think back past the sweater.
Yeah. So it was probably 1996 or 97. I had been in New York for 2 years. I was teaching aerobics back then, like 20 aerobics classes a week.
Oh, God.
I was exhausted. And I was like, I love teaching, but I can't do this any longer. And I was looking for something else to do. And I had been teaching on the west side of Manhattan, walking through Central Park to the east side where I lived. And I paused on 79th Street and 3rd Avenue at the intersection.
Hold on, 79th and 3rd.
It's where the Crosstown bus used to go.
Yeah, I think I can visualize that block still.
Yeah. There was a store, so I turned to the left, and your power yoga book was there in the window. And it was as if a long hand came towards me and pulled me in. Get that book.
Oh, my God. Thanks to Simon & Schuster for putting it out there.
Right? I turned, I walked in, I bought the book, went home, read that you were the official program of the New York Roadrunners Club. Back then, I think I had a computer, but I didn't have the internet. So I had a client who had his own company who had the internet. So I said, Frank, could you look this up and see how can I find Beryl? Where is this Roadrunners Club? Little did I know that it was just like 10 blocks away from where I lived. So Frank gathered the information, found out that you had a beginner's course, and we signed up to the beginner's course together.
Oh my God, this is unbelievable.
It was an 8-week beginner's course, and you were teaching, Tom was teaching, and then you announced that you were going to have a teacher training. And I was like, I have to do that. I didn't have much money and I was so exhausted, but I worked a few extra aerobics classes a week to afford it and take off for a week. But yeah, I was determined to go. And that's how we met. It was just like, it was just divine intervention. It was, when you're ready, the teacher will appear. And you were the best teacher that I could ever have, because Ashtanga yoga is a hard practice. And it was the best practice for me because it was very much disciplined. You had to be disciplined. And I was not the type of person that could like really do something that was a set thing, because I needed variation. But that was the foundation really that I needed to get that discipline going, and I'm just so grateful for that. But also, you have a very different way of teaching. You would bring in blocks, you would give us modifications, which was not, you know, done in traditional Ashtanga teaching.
Oh, Jesus, no.
Right? And I remember one time teaching with some teachers, and
oh my god,
how is this going to go? Here I am bringing in a block, I'm bringing in a strap, I'm giving modifications. Afterwards, they were like, oh wow, that was amazing, I hadn't even thought that you could do a modification like that. And I'm like, yeah, my teacher Beryl Bender Birch taught me that.
You know, you just brought up so many important things. I mean, the word discipline. My Ashtanga Asana teacher, Norman Allen, who gave me my first copy of the Yoga Sutra back in 1979 when I started the practice. You know, when I saw him do a demonstration, he had one student, and I saw him work with her and do a demo at the Jain Meditation Center on 86th and 3rd, Lady 6th between Lexington and 3rd. And I was just like, I went, oh my God, this is yoga. This is incredible. I'd never, you know, in the 70s, yoga was very soft and stretchy. And it was something that only women did. Men wouldn't be caught dead doing yoga. And here comes this kick ass, athletic, solid, heavy duty training. And I went, I got to learn this. And Norman said, you want to do this? He said, okay. Here's the deal. 6 months, 24 days a month, 5:30 in the morning. You miss a day, you're out. Yes or no, no pressure. And I just moved from California, you know, where you go, oh, you smoke a joint, you put a crystal on your head, you go out to the desert and drop some acid. You know, it was like, oh, you know, whatever. I went, oh, my God, this is shit. So I just, but, you know, I wanted the teaching. And I wanted to learn how to do this. And the first day I show up, and he goes, oh, this is good. You're here. Great. Come on in. You sit down. You watch. Sat and watched. And I'm looking around going, when am I going to get to do this? And then I said, Beryl, that's very good. You come back tomorrow. I went back. You may have heard this story. I've told this story a bunch of times.
Yeah.
Went back the next day. Beryl, you're here again. Good. Come on in. You sit down. You walk. Well, this went on for like a week, you know, and I'm finally going, okay, Norman, I got your number. I see what you're doing here. No way. I don't give a shit if I ever learn this or not, but I am not going to show up. I am determined I will be here till my dying day. You know, well, that's classic in the yoga literature. You know, the student wants a teaching. The teacher says, oh, you come in, you just sweep the floor. And he has you sweep the floor for 6 months. Finally, he started teaching me, you know, a couple postures a day. And that's how you learned it. So discipline, I learned that's the only way you can learn discipline is you build your discipline little by little by little by little.
Yeah.
And when I started working with runners who were so tight and athletes, and really, I have to say, I was kind of responsible for introducing yoga into the athletic community. I mean, that's, people sort of credit me with that. And I go, yeah, I'll take credit for that. I think that.
Yeah, sure.
That you had to, the only way you could have athletes access this practice, which I thought was going to be fantastic to prevent injuries and rehab injuries, was to make the postures accessible. And yeah. If you stick to this hardcore, you know, cast in stone methodology without any, you know, that was my whole principle, was hard and soft.
Yeah,
in
exactly.
Order to be extremely in order to be extremely hard and strong, you need to be extremely pliable and soft. And so there's a balance there. And I've been following that Zen proverb for decades, you know. So modifying the postures and, oh, Jesus, calling it power yoga to try and make it more accessible to Western mind and to men, that is where was the, that was the final heretical movement. I mean, that got me thrown out of the church. That was heresy. You know, it was put on the blacklist and you're out. But it taught me to stand on my own two feet, you know, that I went. And because, you know, coming full circle now to today and reconnecting with you and seeing how this affected all of us. I often say if it weren't for yoga, I'd be dead or in jail. And I think I stole that line from David Swensen, but it's true.
You were such a pioneer and you really stood your ground. And now we wouldn't think twice, you know, to not give a modification or to make adjustments, right? But back then, that was not acceptable.
And the most hardcore of these Ashtangis who have gotten older and hopefully wiser are now all doing modifications and go, oh, yeah, I see. I see the reasoning behind this, you know, that, yeah. But for a while when, you know, when power yoga first came out and there was this, you know, you, anytime you go up against an existing paradigm, you are going to face some serious resistance, and generally some very well-funded resistance. In this case, it was the male front line, all the male Ashtangis that were students of Batavi Joyce. And look what eventually happened. I mean, I'm glad I wasn't a devotee of Batavi Joyce. I was respectful. I was a good student. I certainly, if it hadn't been for him, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation now. You and what's happening. It was hard to stand outside the, you know, to stand outside the circle and feel like you were cast out. No, I remember some guy challenged me and he said, "Well, I don't know. This is a very rajasic practice, and I could never do this at night. And you know, I don't know how great a practice this is." And here's going back to your very first question: what are you learning now? You know, and I look at how my answer to that has changed. Back then, I was so defensive. I was like, you know, how could you attack this practice? It's such a great practice. And I was, you know, you could do it. Now I would go, you know, thank you for saying that. You're absolutely right. It is a rajasic practice. This practice is probably not for you. And you learn to be more, you know, malleable. Mm-hmm. And catch yourself. Catch those negative, fearful, reactive responses to things. You know, I talked about that this morning in my meditation course. You know, you can use suffering, and I'm going to use the word suffering to sort of encapsulate any negative or emotion or thought you have. You know, well, I'm frustrated. I'm annoyed. I'm insulted. I'm in pain. How could you do that? Well, that didn't go the way I wanted to go. Well, this is very disappointing. Well, I'd be happier if things were this way instead of this way. Anytime you're suffering, and we're obviously not talking about the suffering of people that are displaced by war or famine or, you know, but the suffering, self-created suffering. You know, you can use that kind of as like an alarm clock to just, wow, anytime, this is the practice, becoming aware of the thought that is creating the feeling. Here, your meditation training can be useful because it gives you the ability to respond. What am I trying? It gives you the ability to respond to the alarm, right? You notice that you're in pain. And if you can just get outside yourself for a second, go, wow, here's an example. I'm suffering. I'm annoyed because this didn't go the way I wanted it to go. Anytime we notice that, there's only one reason that we're suffering. It's because we're lost in thought. The mind is going, oh my God, how could that person do that? I'm so much, you know, or I'm so, how could I have said that? I'm such a worthless person. I should learn. I should know better. You're so judgmental of yourself or somebody else. Until you learn a practice like mindfulness, there's no alternative. You're going to continue to suffer. Mm-hmm. You'll live basically at the whim of the next sentence or the next image that pops into your mind. But once you've learned how to meditate, close your eyes, settle down, catch the thought, notice that you've been distracted, that you've been trapped by a thought, and come back to this moment, come back to the breath or the mantra, whatever you're focusing on, the thought just disappears.
Yeah.
So once you can pay attention to this, what was the word I used this morning? This automaticity. I'm thinking that's a word. Then you have a choice and say, wait a minute, I don't have to take that road. I can choose to be happy. You know, this is just, once the thought disappears, you can't maintain suffering once the thought stops because the thought is what creates the emotional distress. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And this podcast is called Phases, and it's about evolving through our life, that we go through different phases is if I'm too attached to a particular way of being or a particular thought or belief system, if it's not working for me, then I'm sort of stuck in a suffering, in a phase that no longer serves me.
This is deliberate training of the mind. And that's, to me, what meditation is, that it's this, again, learning to tell the difference between being lost in thought and being awake, being present, being conscious of what is arising in the field of consciousness in this moment. In the beginning, you may learn that practice of ekatattva, of one-pointedness. And that is a legitimate meditation practice of focusing your attention on one thing. It's a very yogic practice where you're just focusing on the breath, let's say. You're focusing on one thing and everything else is fading out. Once you train the mind the way we do in asana, the way you do in pranayama, and now you're moving through the limbs and now you've jumped into the inner limbs, right? It's a different experience. Once you have some basic training of the mind, you can begin to open that field up a little bit and allow everything in. You can just focus on what is arising in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And then you notice you've been distracted, you know, by something you see. Oh, I see a squirrel. And that triggers a thought and goes, those damn squirrels are eating all my bird food. Oh my God, I have to go out and buy bird food again today. Oh, I'm wondering, it's getting so expensive and oh, I need to go. All of a sudden, you're on the bus riding down the road and you're not back at the bus stop just watching the buses go by. So the training, the formal training, why do we do it? Why do we want to meditate? That's the first thing I ask people when they come into these courses. I mean, I think I told you before we started recording that I've just been doing 5 months of every morning, Tuesday mornings, of working through the different establishments of mindfulness in the Vipassana tradition. But why are we doing it? We want to be better. We want to be more present. We want to be less trivial, more engaged, more connected, to be more of more use in the world. It's preparation for every moment that is yet to come. And hopefully there'll be a lot more. There was a wonderful, Jane Fonda gave a phenomenal acceptance speech at the Screen Actors Guild Awards.
I heard it. I love her.
Oh my God, she was fantastic. You know,
amazing.
She's already planning out her 90s, what she's going to, she's a, you know, and she went through the same thing. God, she was trying to show compassion. You have to choose. You know, all of a sudden she was the enemy. And it's only because people didn't have the capacity to realize there's only one of us here. I mean, as soon as you have the experience of yoga, which is the experience of connectedness and boundlessness, there is no other anymore. And I think that's what life is teaching me now, is that I've pretty much come to the place where the boundary between my formal meditation, you know, there's sitting meditation in the morning, and then there's the rest of your life, right? And that's, my work has always been my life. I've never felt a real difference between doing my work and the rest of my life. It's all been pretty seamless. So that boundary between formal meditation and the rest of my life is pretty much my walks in the woods and the rest of my day is not really significantly different than my morning sitting practice.
Yeah, because it's a way of being for you. It's
really used, and you said it before, so it's 24/7.
I have always tried to teach from a lens of yoga wisdom, and asana was important, but I always come back to the yoga wisdom. And that was something that you always did, that I was always inspired by you. You would always pull in the Yoga Sutra or refer to some other Eastern philosophy. And that also stuck with me, that that became a part of my practice. And going through perimenopause, that became essential for me, because there was times when asana didn't feel as good and I had to adjust my asana practice. But it was just that philosophy that get back to my breath, be present, be here now. What is life teaching me at the moment? And that is a daily practice, minute by minute, hour by hour. And I also say to my students, so why are you practicing yoga? What is yoga to you?
And that's a great thing to bring up, because I don't think it's a bad thing that there was so much focus on asana. It's the, as you know, the third limb. It's the way most people get into yoga. I didn't make any connection between asana and meditation. I started meditating in 1971 because I'd met my teacher, Munishri Chitrabanu. And he was a Jain monk from India that came here at the invitation of Harvard Divinity School to represent the Jain tradition, which is very similar to Buddhism. And then I studied in California with Choyam Trungpa Rinpoche, so I had the Buddhist influence, but those two are so similar. And, you know, so I'd been meditating pretty regularly and training, but I started out with really ekatattva, just focusing on one thing, training your mind. I didn't start Vipassana until, oh my God, I don't know, 10 years ago or so, when I started, maybe longer, when I started studying Buddhism a little more vigorously, a little more intently, a little more with a little more regularity, total regularity. And, you know, I forget where I was going with that, but
that maybe you were more focused.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I know where I was going. This just happens every once in a while. Like, what was I saying? that I may have just lost it again. No, that this link between asana and meditation. Right? They were two separate things. And it wasn't until Norman Allen gave me a copy of the Yoga Sutra in 1979. And I went, oh, look, this is an eight limb path. Asana is designed simply to get you ready for meditation. It begins the process of training your mind to pay attention, to concentrate, focus. And that was like a major enlightenment. The phases, that's a great title for your podcast, because, you know, people do go in phases. When you first come to asana, you know, that's pretty much what you're focused on, is the body. Yeah. It's the first establishment of mindfulness. It's not till you can work through the body that you can get to the second establishment of mindfulness, which is dealing with mental formations, with your thoughts and feelings. Like, oh, look, but you can't really process the subtle nature of thought before you've kind of worked through being able to downregulate the physical body. Can I catch myself when I get stressed, when I get tense? Can I see how my thoughts relate to what happens in my body? Can I settle? Can I calm the pond, as Thich Nhat Hanh says?
This connection between the breath and asana was always there in the Ashtanga practice, which I have always held on to. And then when I went a little bit more into vinyasa, I always held on to connecting breath with movement because I had that Ashtanga foundation. One thing that was challenging to rid myself of was the counting.
Counting the breath?
Yeah, counting the breath.
Still count. I still go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and I think, okay, let's do 8 today.
Yeah, but it was funny, one time I took a class and there was one teacher who was counting in a way that was so annoying to me. And that day, my brain was just like monkey mind, up and down. And I was just focused on how annoying he was. And all of a sudden, without even thinking, I blurted out, "Oh, shut up."
Oh, gee.
And he went, "What?" But after that, my mind went completely still. It was the funniest thing, but it was very embarrassing.
Oh, my God. Well, probably other people were thinking the same thing. I don't know, unless, you know, everybody's different. Some people probably love. All he said was what? He didn't come over and, like, throw you out of class?
Maybe I didn't say it as loud as I thought that I said it. It was like, it just felt like I just blurted it out.
Oh, God, that's too funny. You know, and that gets me thinking about our likes and dislikes, you know. Like this morning before I got on with you, we were going to take this kettlebell workout. So Ellen and I are on together and we're doing exercises and everything. I was doing this thing with the TheraBand around your ankles where you crab, you know, you crab walk. You step one foot out and then you move the other one, you step it out and move it. I said, God, I really, really hate this. And then I said, nobody cares. Nobody cares whether I don't like it or not. You know, it's preference. It's just do it and shut up. You know, that's funny. And that not having a preference is kind of one of the things that I'm really working on a lot now. No preference is that just sit back and watch and wait. Do the work, speak up, you know, speak up for the five yamas, speak up for truth and justice and nonviolence and all the things you believe in. I mean, I'm a pretty ardent activist for the environment and for animals. So I don't, especially as I've gotten older, I'm less fearful about speaking my mind. I don't really care if people don't like it or not, but trying to have less preference about things and practice saying, well, I have no preference. What would you like to
do? I love that. I love that. That resonates so much with me. And I'm so glad that you brought up the resistance bands. And also before we got started, you talking about doing weights. And, you know, you wrote the foreword to my book, which was about having yoga as the foundation for an exercise program and then integrating strength training and cardiovascular. That was 2004. You were on board with that. And back then we called it cross training or like a fusion workout. What I was doing then wasn't so accepted in the yoga world because back then the messaging was very much that yoga is all that we need.
Yoga was everything.
Yoga was everything.
For yogis, yoga was all you needed to do, right? That probably came from the, you know, the Indian tradition of.
That's interesting you say that. Maybe it did, but I think it's also came from sort of the westernization probably of yoga that, and everyone felt like I'm feeling really strong in this practice and this feels like it's, this is really good for me. So yeah. How can it not be good for my muscles and for my bones? And then the study that came out that all you needed to do was those 12 yoga poses daily, that was quite faulty. But that contributed a lot to a lot of yogis thinking that yoga was all they needed. So many yogis now are diagnosed with osteoporosis and osteopenia. And what are your thoughts about a lot of the yoga poses being, you know, contraindicated for someone who has osteopenia or osteoporosis? I'd really love to hear your experience and your thoughts on this.
No, I think you brought up a good thing about the one of the reasons why, you know, that because we got so enamored with yoga, we felt that it would be enough. And I think the reason you brought up in terms of the Western view of it also contributed. I think you're right there. I think, you know, there's no one answer to that because everybody it depends. You know, my students always say, when you ask Beryl a question, the first thing she's going to say is, it depends. It depends on how old you are, whether you have osteopenia, whether you have advanced osteoporosis, whether you're small boned or you're large boned, whether what your diet is. I mean, I have pretty severe osteoporosis, and I still do shoulder stand and, you know, all the back bending, and I don't do the extreme postures. I have never really done the super extreme postures. In my Ashtanga practice, all I ever did was first and second series, and maybe the first couple postures in third series. I've had both hips replaced. Certainly at one point, people questioned, well, you know, if you weren't doing yoga your whole life, why would you need to have your hips replaced? You know, and I went, well, you know, perhaps you don't realize that yogis are going to die as well. Sooner or later, no matter what you do, you know, something's going to start to break down. So because I'm very, very, very small boned, I don't think you know anybody that has a smaller wrist circumference than I do. I was at high risk of osteopenia. I was a runner. When I fell in Mexico a couple of years ago and got a tiny fracture in this wrist, I tripped over some broken sidewalk, and they did some x-rays, and they said, oh my God, you have look at your bones. You have really, you know, osteoporosis. I went, oh yeah, I kind of know it. And so I started taking a plant-based calcium and regularly every single day, and I've developed some bone density since then. I've fallen not just because I'm older. I've been falling my whole life. I fractured my pelvis a couple of years ago, a year and a half ago. I was in a wheelchair for 2 months recovering, and I'm 100% healed, and it healed very quickly because I followed instructions, and because I was pretty fit and healthy and going into it, they did x-rays and go, oh, you have osteoporosis and you can't do. Well, I've been doing my yoga practice regularly. The standing postures, the seated postures, I do camel, you know, Ustrasana, I do Shalabhasana A, Shalabhasana B, Urdhva Dhanurasana, Dhanurasana, all of the, you know, the doable backward bending. I'm not trying to put my head up my ass going backwards, but, you know, people I know that have pushed to get that far have all had back surgery. So I think you have to be moderate and pay attention. But I've been vegetarian since 1971, and I've been vegan for probably 5 or 6 years. But I ate a lot of cheese, a lot of butter, a lot of half and half in my coffee, and I had to kind of abandon all that to deal with some health issues. But and being vegan really suits me a lot more, just in terms of my, you know, environmental commitments and animal commitments. And, you know, I was always mindful of sourcing my dairy products. I didn't support factory farming. But yeah, I don't think there's an easy answer to that question. I think you have to look at what you're eating, what your bone size is. I think for some people, it could be very risky. I certainly agree with the premise that doing yoga and holding the postures and squeezing the muscles. See, I always taught muscle contraction against the bone. Putting pressure against the bone strengthens the bone. Most yoga practitioners do not contract consciously the opposing muscle to the one that's stretching. So when you're doing a forward bend, I have always taught you're focused on the quadriceps and you're squeezing them and pushing them against the bone. Yeah. That will develop bone strength. But without that caveat, without that instruction, just doing yoga postures without mindfully working the strength aspect of it, I don't think it'll work. Is that
well? The thing is, like, muscle pulls on bones, so that action, of course, will contribute. But the way that bones get stronger is by that added resistance. So either jumping or adding an external weight, like your kettlebell or yeah. your dumbbell. But just holding a yoga pose itself doesn't do anything to strengthen the bones.
I don't think that's true. I think that you are holding weight. If you're doing bakasana, or you're doing a posture where you're holding, you know, navasana, you're holding your legs up, you're using your muscles to hold your legs, or you're doing a lot of these postures, you know, even triangle pose, you're holding weight. The bones are supporting weight. Now, if strengthening requires repetitive movement, dynamic muscle contraction, then you're probably right. If static muscle contraction is an weight holding is enough to strengthen a bone, which I think it is. I could be wrong, but I think static muscle contraction of weight holding can be bone strengthening. So we should check on that. We should look and see whether it's only dynamic contractions that work, that you're doing this with
it's
weight.
Mostly dynamic contraction. And then also when you go through perimenopause with the hormonal fluctuations, like estrogen plays such a huge role on our bone formation. But then postmenopause, that acceleration of bone loss and muscle loss doubles. So if you're not doing that impact training or the resistance training and you just do asana, it's not enough to keep up with the bone loss.
Not enough. I definitely agree with that. It's not enough, particularly as you get older.
I feel sometimes the dialogue about osteoporosis is very fear-based. Like, if you fall and you have a fracture, you're going to die 6 months later.
What all my friends were telling me, when I fell playing pickleball, fractured my pelvis in a wheelchair, all my closest friends were going, "Oh my God, Beryl, you know what happens when seniors fall and break their hip?" I said, "I did not break my hip. I fractured my pelvis. Let's be careful." And I said, "I am not dying." They said, "Oh yeah, but most people die when that happens." I go, "Holy shit, thank you so much for your support." You're right. That's exactly what happens.
Yeah, my mother too has osteoporosis, fell, broke her hip. That was over a year ago. She's still alive. She's 82, you know? And I'm like, I don't believe that you'll die 6 months later. I think there's more to it than that.
Dying? What? Over my dead body, am I not dying? Yeah, but I'm just mindful and doing what I need to do to keep the bones strong.
Yeah.
And, the healing went, I'm just really grateful that I healed up so quickly. I mean, it happened on August 30th, and November 15th, I got on a plane and flew to Santa Fe, New Mexico from Massachusetts.
Oh,
and
wow.
Went down there, sold my house, packed up the house, shipped a bunch of stuff up here, sold a bunch of stuff on Facebook Marketplace. I had a friend come down and help me. We had a ride, but we spent a week, you know, sleeping on air beds as we packed up and sold all the furniture and, you know, just got on a plane and flew home again and just kept on going, you know. But I was really mindful during the time that I was recovering to do the physical therapy and eat perfectly and eat, you know, I did juices and, you know, kale and all the incredibly healthy vegetables and, you know, all the things you need to do to heal quickly.
Yeah, that's back to how we started discipline and also what you said, sort of having no preference, just getting the work done. Just getting the work done.
Do the work. That's been my motto for a long time. Just do the work.
Do the work.
Do your practice and pay attention.
I have to come in here after the interview and after I have edited this podcast episode just to say, let us put a pin in this discussion on osteoporosis and fractures. I am a little bit fearful that this discussion that Beryl and I had comes across as a little bit laissez-faire in a way. From what I got from it is that Beryl was in good shape when it happened, and she took good care of herself while she was healing. She did the program that she was given diligently, and she ate a good, nourishing diet. I think these things play a huge role. And also, I know she's been strength training, so she has a fair amount of muscle. And it's a nuanced conversation. I don't believe it's just you'll have a fracture and you'll die 6 months later. I think it's important to pause and to look at who are those people who die 6 months after having fractures. Were they in good shape when they had the fracture? Did they have muscle? Did they have strength? How is their diet? How is their heart, right? How is their healthcare? How is their support system around them? So that's why I was saying, I think this discussion often is very fear-based. We hear you'll have a fracture and you'll die 6 months later. So I wanted to put a pin in this, have discussions about this later, and just let you know that having osteoporosis is not a risk to life. You can live a perfectly healthy and thriving life with osteoporosis. Of course, the risk to life is if you have a fracture. But then I believe the determining factor if you have a fracture is how much muscle do you have on your body? How strong are you? How physically in shape are you? What is your diet? And I think all those factors contribute a lot to the aftermath of having that fracture. So I had to put this in here because I also recognize that I'm not a professional podcaster. I'm not a professional interviewer. So I didn't do a good enough job of asking follow-up questions. I was lacking there, and I apologize for that. So I had to insert this just to make sure. But we will continue discussions like this in later podcasts. Thank you.
So before we end, I want to not leave you without acknowledging Tom, who was just so dear to me. And I think about him very often, as I do you, and especially in how you taught me to teach, always do things with care and with love and respect. So I had to acknowledge Tom and you for exceptional teaching and just being there. Best start to my yoga practice and career that I could have ever gotten.
Thank you. That's I appreciate that. No, I'm sure Tom would appreciate it too. You know, he had his demons. He was kind of a tortured soul on many levels, and was a wonderful teacher. Being on the spectrum, which we didn't realize until maybe about a year before he died, and his bipolar disorder, all of the which contributed to the demons that he carried. He grew up in a very abusive household and struggled with a lot of mental health issues, but he was a great teacher. And certainly great at adjustments. You know, the philosophy of yoga was not something that he was around long enough to begin to appreciate, but he was really good at the teaching the asana. He was a great coach.
And just such a good heart. That's what I'm left with. Such a good heart.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, he absolutely had a great heart, really kind to people and very inclusive and really wanted to draw everybody in.
I agree.
If it weren't for him, we would never have moved out to East Hampton, because he was a great runner and a world-class runner. We were offered opportunity to buy a house out there in 93 for $200,000, and I sold it in 2012 for about four times that much, and that's how I'm able to be up here in the Berkshires, and, you know, was able to buy and sell a house in Santa Fe, and, you know, so I have debt of gratitude to him as well. He was my toughest teacher. It's definitely a tough teacher. I asked for a tough teacher. I didn't expect to get it in him, but yeah, it was a pretty tough road to hoe. If you,
yeah, be careful what you wish for, you will get it. Just like what I wanted. I wanted a new teacher and I got it. But you weren't so tough like that. You were just perfect for what I needed.
Once you find the insight that you have a choice in any moment to be kind or to catch yourself when you're, that you can cultivate the opposite. And that doesn't mean that we're manipulating experience. It means that you're just noticing what you're feeling in this moment, noticing the thought that generated a feeling of being uncomfortable or angry or depressed or sad or lonely or whatever you're feeling. And it's possible to feel different, suddenly to feel very differently, because the minute you catch it and you notice the thought, it disappears. And for an instant, there's a moment of freedom. Yeah. There's a moment of happiness. It's a very subtle shift, but it's revolutionary. And once you notice you're cranky or bored or whatever, and you're mindful of it, you kind of notice the half-life.
Yeah.
And that's practice we're doing, that it's possible in a flash to feel another way, to access a different attitude. And yeah, once you have that degree of mindfulness, all you have to do is remember to do it, that you can do it, to decide to do it. Suddenly you can be content or grateful. And you go about your day. I say to myself a lot something I learned from Sam Harris, who's probably my primary teacher right now. Banish the ghost of mediocrity from your day. Whatever you're doing, banish the ghost of mediocrity. As you go about the day and you feel the mediocrity of the day intruding, just remember love and beauty and gratitude and be present.
Yeah, I love that. It reminds me of Pratipaksha Bhavanam. It is that whole flip the switch. Just flip it.
Pratipaksha means to flip it over, and Bhavana is cultivate. Cultivate the opposite.
Yeah.
Good. Well, Anita, oh my God, I want to come to London and hang out with you.
I know. I have to come to one of your retreats now. This has continued.
Totally sold out. Somebody just canceled, but then somebody else just popped into that room. Maybe you can come. Oh, who knows? We're going back to Guatemala next February.
Definitely at some point. So do you have anything you'd like to say as parting words, or something we haven't covered that you like to share? We've talked a long time now, but this has just been so indulgent and lovely.
Nothing further.
That's it. Well, thank you so much, Beryl. This has been such a joy, at least for me, selfishly. I hope that this has been enjoyable for those listening too. I do think that my students will appreciate this, as they have heard so much about you and all the things that I have passed on to them. I hope it's been enjoyable. Was it okay for you, Beryl? Did you enjoy it?
It was fantastic. I totally enjoy it. How could you not? You have turned into such a wise and kind, and you've always been wise and kind. You're just more wise and more kind than you used to be. And I couldn't be happier or more proud of, you know, the work you're doing. And, you know, people who are students of yours, they're just in the lineage. You're just passing along the teaching. And, you know, may the merit of our practice be dedicated to the upliftment and enlightenment of all beings everywhere.
Exactly. That is the intention. That's the intention. The gift that keeps on giving is yoga. Thank you so much.
Namaste.
Namaste.